This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As a young boy in Stanley County, North Carolina, Wade Smith didn't know what he wanted to be when he grew up, but he knew he had a deep desire to do something good and useful. Now, his grandfather was a Baptist preacher, and Wade watched him bring grown men to tears using only words. So he realized the power of speech in those moments, and he thought this longing and about his longing to do something positive might be what people like his granddaddy referred to as a calling. He excelled in both sports and academics in high school, earned the Moorhead Scholarship to UNC Chapel Hill, went on to law school at UNC, and then a clerkship with the state Supreme Court. After a brief stint as a prosecutor, Wade Smith and his classmates started the firm now known as Therrington Smith. His calling, he discovered, was to find the good in everyone, even society's worst criminal offenders. With more than five decades of legal practice under his belt, including several high-profile cases like the Fatal Vision trial and the Duke LaCrosse defendants, Wade Smith has earned the name Dean of the Defense Bar, and he joins me now in the State of Things. Welcome back, Wade Smith. Good
Thanks.
To have you here.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you here. So we talked about your grandfather, this Baptist preacher. What kind of influence did he have on you growing up?
What a happy thing it is for me to remember him. He was a farmer. He had a whole house full of children. This was in Stanley County, Acredale, North Carolina, a small little community. And his wife died, and he was working on this hardscrabble farm, and he got a call to the ministry. He used to talk to me about the call and how you couldn't escape the call. It was like Jonah couldn't escape the call, and that he couldn't. And I remember thinking, well, what was it like? Was it a loud voice? He said, no, Wade, it's a feeling. It's just a feeling you have. And so I grew up believing that everyone had a call. It was not just one or two people who had the call, but everyone is called to do something. And so I felt maybe this is like the church lady saying, how convenient. But I felt like that I had a call to the law. And I've never looked back and never regretted it at all.
When did you first feel that?
Well, I guess I felt it all the way through high school, though I didn't realize for sure. Though I did admire the lawyers in our community because they seemed to be in all the leadership positions, the good things that were done, that they would be on the county commission, they would be on the school board. They would be on the library committee. I don't know how our town would have made it without them. And I admired them, and I thought, well, that would be something good maybe to do, that if I could be a lawyer. So,
and what did your parents do? Tell us about growing up.
Well, my mother and dad were children of the Depression. So I was born in 1937. So the Depression was hardly over. As a matter of fact, it wasn't over. But they lived, my grandfather, after he became a minister, he served a small church in East Rockingham, called it the East Rockingham Baptist Church. And these people were, as I look back on it, just as poor as they could be. I mean, there just wasn't any money anywhere. And my dad grew up in those surroundings, and his wife, my mom, was the same. She lived on that mill village. Her daddy, who couldn't read and write, couldn't talk plain, he worked in that mill. And so they knew each other. But then in the eighth grade, they had to stop school. And they went to work in the cotton mill, as did everybody else. And they did their courting in the spinning room, as I recall, of Hannah Pickett Cotton Mill in East Rockingham, North Carolina.
So they didn't have a college education themselves. What kind of emphasis did they place on higher education for you?
Well, you know, they pushed us and pushed us. I had a brother, Roger, who's certainly smarter than I am and a better lawyer. But he and I were pushed by our parents. They always said to us, you must go to college. We can't pay for it. You'll have to find a way yourself, but you must go. So we never doubted that we would go to college. And we were so proud of them because after we'd finished at Chapel Hill, they went back to the community college and got their degree, their high school degree, their diplomas. We went down and had a great celebration. And
you found two ways to go to UNC. You had an athletic scholarship and the Morehead, and you chose the Morehead, right?
I did. I chose the Morehead. I appreciated that opportunity so much. It was just a wonderful thing. And that way I could play football, but I wasn't on a scholarship. I didn't have two scholarships, so I had just the Morehead. But I could play, and I enjoyed the game. It was different in those years because we weren't thinking about playing professional football. So it was just a joyful thing to do, to be on the team.
So the Morehead gets you through undergrad, but you got to figure out a way to pay for law school. How'd you do that?
Well, yes, that's right. Well, so I applied at the law school, and so interesting, I had no way to pay for it. There was not a chance in the world that I could pay for it, but it didn't worry me. It didn't cross my mind. I look back on it and think, why didn't I worry myself to death about it? But I just didn't worry about it. I thought, well, you know, a way will be opened. And so one day I was down visiting the team after my senior year. I went down to watch the team work out in spring practice, and my coach asked me, well, Wade, would you like to have a job helping coach the freshman team, and we'll pay your way through law school? And there, the waters were parted, and I crossed the river.
You did. You got through law school, and you clerked for Justice Carlisle Higgins after law school. Tell us about him, and tell us about that interview that you had with him.
Well, he was a great man. He was one of the most down-to-earth people I've ever known. He was a mountain man from Sparta, raised there.
And I should say, this is State Supreme Court Justice.
Yes, right? State Supreme Court. Yeah. He came down to Chapel Hill and went to school, and then he was the chief prosecutor of the Japanese war trials. He was a brilliant man, and he was also a federal prosecutor before he went to the Supreme Court. But so, yes, thanks for reminding me about that interview. I did not write him and ask for a job when I graduated from law school. I didn't write and ask him. I didn't know for sure what I was going to do then. I figured the waters would part somehow, you know. And so I got this letter from him, and it said, be in my office at a particular time. And I had never met him. So I put on my best tie and went over to see Judge Carlisle Higgins of the North Carolina Supreme Court. And I was ushered into his office. He sat there looking at me. He didn't say anything. And I sat there and I felt a little uneasy. And he said to me, boy, can you play poker? I said, yes, sir. He said, you'll do. So I came and took that job. And wow, what a wonderful experience it was. What a great initiation into a serious business of being a judge on the Supreme Court and writing briefs and helping him with his opinions.
Would you ever find out how he came to choose you and send you that letter?
I still have no idea, and I didn't ever ask him. I didn't want to know. Maybe he was mistaken. I was somewhere else.
You were somebody else. How is he at poker? How was he at poker?
Well, you know, I never played a game with him, but I'll bet you he was fantastic.
I'm guessing. What kind of things do you learn in a play? Again, you weren't looking for it, but now there you are in the State Supreme Court clerking. What did you learn?
Well, I learned an awful lot of what I would call the lore of the law. I learned to really appreciate this profession. I learned to really appreciate the women and men who are the lawyers and the judges and the professors. I learned to be proud to be a lawyer and to value the profession itself.
I mean, you were watching the sausage being made, and you're saying you didn't have a couple of moments of cynicism back there behind the scenes?
You know, with him, there wasn't much sausage. He was just absolutely straight as an arrow, and you always knew exactly what he was thinking, what he was going to do. But it was interesting to see the relationships of the judges and how important it was that they were working together to find the answers in the cases that we had there. So in that way, sausage was being made because they would argue about those mm-hmm. things and find somehow a way to the right decision. And so sausage was being made in a way. But sausage was really made at the General Assembly where I ended up years
later.
We're
going to talk more about that in a couple of seconds. Did he give you any good advice?
He gave me an awful lot of good advice, and the thing about him that I admired the most was he was so positive. At the end of his life, he was 93 years old. He had joined our firm when he finished at the Supreme Court. He fell and broke his nose as an old man, and I went to the hospital to see him, and he said, "Wade, don't worry about it. It's a good thing. It cleared up a nasal problem I'd had for years." So this was the world's foremost positive thinker.
Wade Smith is a Raleigh-based defense attorney, and we're going to continue our conversation with him, including his years in the General Assembly of North Carolina, and much, much more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour, defense attorney Wade Smith, defense attorney, now a well-known defense attorney, certainly in North Carolina, the entire region, and has a reputation across the country. But your first job was a prosecutor.
My first job was as a prosecutor. Yes, it was, after I left the clerkship with mm-hmm. Judge Higgins.
What made you decide to do that, or how did you get into that?
Well, I had not made a decision about what to do after my clerkship was ended, and I was thinking about what should I do. And this job opened in Wake County with Buck Ransell, who was a wonderful trial lawyer, and he was the chief prosecutor. And everyone said, "You should go down and apply." I applied for the job and somehow got it, and enjoyed that very much. It was really an interesting and good way to start.
That does suggest that criminal law interested you. Had that always been, through law school, your main interest?
It was. It always was, yes.
What do you think it is about criminal law that attracts you?
Well, it was, I think, the idea of using words. And I never thought about it so specifically, but you mentioned in the introduction watching my grandfather use words and make grown men cry without twisting their arms. And I realized that you can string words together into sentences and you can persuade people to agree with you. And so the thing that interested me about that was the idea of advocacy, that is, taking a series of events or facts and choosing from the lexicon of 500,000 words or so in the English language the exact right words in those sentences that would cause people to agree with you. And so I enjoyed that. That was great fun for me, the whole idea of being an advocate.
Now, you can do that as a prosecutor or a defense attorney. You started out as a prosecutor, but you didn't stay that way. Why'd you leave?
Well, I wanted to see if you could string words together on the other side and make them work.
Mm-hmm.
I was eager to try it out. I learned a lot from Buck Ransell and all the lawyers in Wake County. I was very lucky to end up there where there's so many good lawyers. And so I was interested to see, well, if it works on that side, maybe it will work on the other side. So that's why.
We're going to talk more about this, but let's start this part of the conversation now or get this thread open. The idea of using words to be persuasive, to paint a picture that allows people to see it a certain way, that allows people to have a fair trial, to make sure they're getting their best shot at justice. On the other hand, maybe not. Maybe you're just the best storyteller. And so what role, and the way our criminal justice system works is kind of the best storyteller wins, I guess, but is that really justice?
Well, yes, I think so, though the system is not perfect, and no system is perfect. No church choir is perfect. No civic club is perfect. No basketball or football team
Nearly perfect, though, at UNC.
Nearly
they came
perfect
that
at Chapel
close.
Hill.
That close.
I think so. I think
that. Just
that close. But it is the best system, I think, in the world. And it is true that every case has a story. If it's a speeding case, there's a story about how it happened. And so maybe the person who tells the story best has a better chance. It doesn't mean they will necessarily win the case, but if you can tell the story well, you have a better chance.
Of course, this works very well in politics as well, trying to persuade people that your idea should be the winning idea. And you decided to run for public office, but you decided not to tell anybody. Tell us about your run for office.
It is such an interesting thing to me, maybe not to everybody else. But one day I was sitting in my office, at my law office, and this would have been 1972, and I decided, without telling a single soul, including Anne, my wife, without telling anybody I was going to do it, I just simply went down and filed for election to the North Carolina General Assembly. And I came back to my office and said, what have I done? What have I done? I don't have a campaign, but I did it. And it worked out great, thanks to so many nice people who helped.
Well, what was behind that? Something must have motivated that.
I don't think I was struck down on the road to Damascus or something. I think that it was more, I'd like to see if I can do this. I'd like to try this and see if I can do it. I had always been interested in politics, and my father was not a well known in politics or anything. He was just a voter, but he was a big Democrat. When the truck wouldn't start, he'd say the Republicans have gotten into the truck. So I was raised in a household where politics was of interest. And so I just wanted to see if I could do it.
And you were a Democrat?
I was a Democrat.
What were your priorities? What was the public policy?
Well, you know, it was a time to be interested in the environment. So I was really into clean water, clean air. I was really into good schools, good public schools. I did everything I could to help the public schools. And so I went as an idealist and left as an idealist.
Interesting time to be a Democrat in North Carolina. Jesse Helms now proves that a Republican can win in 1972.
Indeed. And as a matter of fact, Jim Holzhauser was the Republican governor the first year I was elected to the General Assembly. I just thought the world of him, just a wonderful person. And, you know, the thing is, we got along great. I don't remember that at all that we were at war with the Republicans. I worked with the Republicans in the General Assembly, worked with Jim Holzhauser. And as a Democrat, I, of course, supported our Democratic candidates, Terry Sanford and Jim Hunt, people like that, but also had really interesting work with Holzhauser and with Governor Jim Martin. Yeah. So in those years, we were not at war with each other.
Well, that's before the Republican Party had engineered the Southern Strategy, which would take them in a very different direction, use race as a very deliberate effort to create a wedge, and it made them a very different party than they were.
Well, it's changed. There's no doubt. It has changed, and it's not fun anymore.
You served as chair of the Democratic Party, right?
I did.
When was that, and what was that like?
That was in the mid-'80s. Robert Jordan had been elected lieutenant governor, and Jim Martin was governor. Robert, it was his assignment to find the person to serve as the party chair. It never had crossed my mind to be party chair. But he asked me to be the Democratic Party chair, and I enjoyed it immensely. It was church work. I went to, I think, just about every county. I made the same speech in every county. But we talked about good schools, clean air, clean water, a great environment, that we can do better, that we can be a great, great nation if we all join in. And the idea that I remember sort of preaching was, we all came here to see what we could accomplish as a great nation, and so let's chip in and help.
Well, that was a message that, again, even resonated with Republicans at the time, the idea that if this was going to be attractive to business, clean air, clean water, good schools, public service, a government that was engaged, all those things, that was not a hard sell even across the aisle, or was it back
then? Oh, it wasn't. Yeah. No, it was. We worked together. Republicans joined with Democrats, and we passed good laws relating to sedimentation control and good environmental laws. It was a great time in North Carolina.
What's happened since then? Because there is not that support for good environment, good schools, the same kind of thing that we'd see.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what happened. I was party chair when the culture wars sort of began, and it was a time when we were devoted to doing something about race relations. We worked hard on race relations in the Democratic Party, and we got busy on all the other things I've discussed, and so we took the Democratic Party in that direction pretty firmly. And some people left the party, and I realized that. I spent a lot of my time trying to persuade people not to leave.
Well, you became a defense attorney. Talk about then, you talked about making the switch, seeing if you could be persuasive in the other direction. You were in the prosecutor's office for a while. Talk about that experience, because clearly that is what you stuck with. Was there a moment when you thought, wow, this is really it, or had that sort of always been your aspiration?
Well, as a young prosecutor, I realized that I felt totally at home in the courtroom. I don't know why. It was almost like I had lived some life earlier and knew what to do and what to say and how to speak to judges and how to speak to jurors. And so it was the most natural thing. As I look back on it, I realized that as a boy, we went to church every time the door opened. We went to church Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, Sunday night, Wednesday night, choir practice, everything. But in those years, the Baptist Church, and maybe all the other denominations, I bet so, we were working on raising young people to be leaders. So every Sunday night, we had what was called Baptist Training Union, where we had to take a piece of literature or something and stand before the class and explain it. I don't know whether that's what it was, but whatever it was that happened to me in my youth, it sort of got me ready to be in the courtroom as an advocate.
As a defense attorney, you have to meet with people who really have committed terrible crimes. You may know that they're not innocent. How do you tackle that?
Well, you know, I'm a great believer in our system, and every single person is entitled to a lawyer and is presumed to be innocent. That's so important to me. And even guilty people have a right to a lawyer and a trial. And the reason for that is they have a right to put the state or the government to its test. Let's see if they really can prove it. As an American citizen, you have a right to require the government to prove it, not just say it, but prove it. And therefore, you have a right to say nothing, to never speak. You have a right to sit in the courtroom with a piece of tape over your mouth and say nothing at all. And the government has the duty to prove it. And if they can't prove it, they don't get to punish you. And one of the things that always has interested me is if you see a town with great lawyers, you will see a town with great police officers. They feed on each other. Really good lawyers make police officers do their work. And really good police officers make lawyers do their work. So what happens is a guilty person is entitled to a defense. He just can't take the witness stand and say that he was in Philadelphia that weekend. You know, he can't tell an untruth.
So you're going to be, you would then advise your client, if you know that they're going to incriminate themselves, you'd advise them not to talk. How do you feel afterward, though? I mean, you've probably already given us the answer, but I want to ask it more pointedly. You know that someone has committed the crime. You've put up a really good defense, and the state really didn't bring it. They're going free. What do you feel like at the end of that?
Well, you know, it isn't like I would be callous about that, and my fellow lawyers would be callous about it. I mean, we certainly take that serious, and we understand that is a strange kind of thing. On the other hand, I always say to myself that I've made our country stronger by insisting that even a despised person got a fair trial. And what I realize and what I think about is that if we ever come to the place in our country where we can't give guilty people a fair trial, we will be in big trouble.
Well, and again, circling back to that point you made earlier, you really need to count on the state to get evidence and to go through the whole process. These are not technicalities. It's a procedure meant to protect each and every one of us in a court of law. And I think your point about good lawyers make good police officers and good judges, everybody's got to be on their toes. If we get lax, then we can start looking at somebody and saying, that looks like the kind of guy who might have done that kind of thing.
Indeed, that's true.
And you don't want to get there.
No.
Now, how do you decide what cases to take?
Well, that's a very good question. I think of a three-legged stool when I'm taking a look at a case. I mean, first of all, am I a person who can help? Is this within my wheelhouse? Do I have the expertise to help? And secondly, will this be a good professional experience? Will I learn something myself? Will I get better at what I do? And will I enjoy working with this person? And last and least is, can they pay a reasonable fee? Not an outrageous fee, but can they pay me enough so I can keep on working and be there for the next person who comes along?
When you get a case, we talked about some of the high-profile cases, the Duke Cross players, Jeffrey McDonald, the Green Beret doctor, who was ultimately convicted of murdering his pregnant wife, two daughters, high-profile case, terrible crime, whoever did it, and it becomes a high-profile media case. Does that change the way you approach?
Well, it changes some of the things that you have to do. For example, in a case with a lot of media, you don't want to ignore the media, and you want to return every phone call. You want to respond. And you have to keep in mind that they're telling the story of this case, and they're speaking to all the jurors who are out there. So you have to keep your eye on that ball. And so you respond to the media, you relate to the media, and you give them the information that you can. You can't give them everything, but even when I can't give them anything, I respond and say, thanks for the call, appreciate it. I wish I could give you something. It'd be inappropriate for me to talk about it now, but maybe later. But that's a high-profile case. You spend time doing that. Sometimes I have a person who does the PR work, who makes those phone calls. As a matter of fact, in almost all cases like that, I have an excellent person who does the PR work and can make those calls for me.
How much effect does it have any effect on the outcome when, you know, we're supposed to be sequestered, the juror is supposed not to pay any attention, but, you know, clearly this stuff is out there?
Well, you know, there was a time when you could keep a case in the courtroom, but you can't now. It's just going to leap out.
Right.
So the story that is being told has a profound impact on what's going to happen ultimately. And you may remember in the Duke LaCrosse case, the defendants were being pretty much skewered by the prosecution, which was telling a story about a woman who had been hurt. And we had to take it to the public. And And under the rules of professional responsibility in North Carolina, you can do that. The lawyers can do that if they're being hurt by statements by this. So you would remember that we went to 60 Minutes, and mm-hmm. 60 Minutes took that, and that was the last show of Mr. Bradley, who was so good on that show. And so it did a great part of the work for us in changing the story that was being told.
Well, we'll also talk about the way wealth and privilege play a part in the criminal justice process when our conversation with Wade Smith, a defense attorney in Raleigh, continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, defense attorney Wade Smith, and we're talking about the criminal justice system and, you know, allowing everybody their day in court. And the fact is we all have a right to that if we're accused of a crime. But wealth and privilege do play a part, don't they? I mean, it seems to me that if you have more money, you're going to get – not that you would do a better job. I wouldn't ask you to say that you would, but you're going to get more services, right? You can pay for more stuff.
It's true. It's true. I don't know what we do about that. Great heroes, I think, in our system of justice now are the public defenders, people who do take care of the poor. They are wonderful lawyers. They do a great job, and I admire them so much. I do pro bono work from time to time. I always have. But it is true that, like in the Duke LaCrosse case, these people had the means to say, look, you can do anything you feel you need to do. You can go anywhere in the world if there's a witness. If there's someone who can help us in Belgium, go there and get that person. As a matter of fact, there was a fake email in that case, and we wanted to find out who sent it, and we traced it with private investigators to Belgium. We had the resources to do that. So, yes, it makes a difference. I wish that wealth and privilege didn't play that role, but it does, and it's rare. Most of the time, I don't represent people who are that way. I wasn't that way myself. I'm not that way myself. Most of the time, it's necessary for them to be as careful as they can, and lawyers do everything they can to hold the expenses down. Sometimes, though, it's a pleasure to represent people who have the means, and in the Duke LaCrosse case, it made a difference.
No, and having the means doesn't disqualify you. Everybody has the right to a fair trial and all of the services that they can afford. So no one would begrudge an individual the right to use their means to get an outcome, and in this case, it was a good outcome.
You're not guilty.
And you're innocent, and that should happen, and all that followed did. But we also know there's been all kinds of wrongful convictions where prosecutors have not suffered the same consequences as Mike Nifong, certainly not as quickly. Some of them actually went on to serve as governor and probably could have been caught, you know, were in cases where there were wrongful convictions and brought wrongful convictions. And we just don't see the same kind of justice for people at the other end of the spectrum.
That's true. That's often true. One of the great things North Carolina has done is be the first state to have an innocence commission. I'm really proud of North Carolina for that, because no system is perfect, and there are people out there who are innocent.
Well, talk about that, because I think that's something that you've been very eloquent on, and the fact that there, you know, when there's an appeal, and I think people, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the appeal is on the procedure. And so if what we're looking at is in an appeal, in the first case, was everything done properly? The question of your actual innocence doesn't come up in the appeal. And that's the difference between actual innocence.
That's right. But actual innocence is what the Innocence Commission is looking at. That's absolutely true. It's not a matter of saying, well, the state didn't carry its burden. In the Innocence Commission work, it is, did you really and truly not do this at all? And are you absolutely factually innocent? And so the Innocence Commission can take the time to explore, to look, to see what other evidence there is. Are there things out there? And often there are things that the police missed. Any police department would miss them, but there are things they missed.
You worked on that commission. What are some of the things that, what are the, some of the patterns that began to emerge for you, or were there patterns?
Well, of course, one of the things that is so wonderful about the Innocence Commission is that it is made up of all of the competing groups in our society that would have a say. So the prosecutors are there, the defense attorneys are there, the victims' advocates are there, and the sheriffs are there, the chiefs of police are there, and they're all on this commission together, and so they look together. And so what you'll find, for example, one case was an Asheville case, and it was a situation in which the wrong people simply pleaded guilty because they wanted to avoid the death penalty, and they were afraid, they were wrongfully accused, and it was a death penalty case, and they were afraid they would be put to death, and so they pleaded guilty and took life in prison, even though they were absolutely innocent. So when the postman was driving through the area where the crime occurred, he saw some garments down, some caps and things thrown in the ditch. He collected them, and they had DNA on them, and that DNA laid there unexamined for years and years. And finally, when it was examined, we knew the wrong people had pleaded guilty. So,
how does that process differ from, we talked about the difference between that and appeal, but how does that process, the innocence process, differ from the trial, the initial trial?
Well, it's too bad that those items could not have been discovered at the trial, but they weren't. So in the Innocence Commission process, the idea is that you can now go back and you can look at every single thing, and you can go through the files, and you can look in spiderweb filled rooms, and you can find little pieces of paper that have evidence on them and hairs that are taped to a little piece of paper, and you can really take your time and you can relax and you can look and you can discover the wrong person has been in prison for 40 years.
Well, it does seem to me that you could have done that same, not you, but the same process and the same care and the same amount of time could have taken place 40 years earlier,
and
you
would have saved
somebody
should've.
40 years earlier. Well, so I guess what I'm getting at is, why isn't what we now call the innocence process or the Innocence Commission, why isn't that our criminal justice process?
Well, that's a very good question. And it comes back, I think, to an earlier thing we talked about, and that is the system cannot be perfect. And we can't be happy if there's one person out there who's innocent. And so while we are dealing with a system that we appreciate and we're grateful for, we know it makes mistakes. And those mistakes would not have been caught in the appellate process. Your point is very well made. Those mistakes would not be caught there, but they would be caught at a later time when people can take a year or two and look and look and look and find. And, of course, one of the things that we know that makes a difference now is DNA. The miracle of DNA enables us to get people out of prison.
But there are patterns. These aren't random errors that happen, because if we look at our prison system, it is way overrepresented by poor people, people of color, people who are mostly dispossessed and disenfranchised. That's a pattern. And if you're talking about taking more time to do the testing on the evidence that, in fact, is in the evidence room, isn't that incumbent on us to make that our process, given the pattern, not the random errors,
but the
pattern that we're seeing?
Yes, it is incumbent upon us, and I hate to make such a general statement to answer your question, but it is incumbent upon us to never be satisfied that our system is not working perfectly, and we know it's not. It isn't the fault of prosecutors or police or lawyers. It is just the way the universe is put together.
Well, I'm going to challenge. I'm going to stay here with this. The universe, the legal system, is not anything that the Almighty put together. There is some creative force that put together the universe. There are some group of human beings that created our legal system, and that legal system is having systematic outcomes that are poor.
Well,
so do we? Can we just say, well, let's just tweak it here and tweak it there? Or don't we have to say, what's the reason all these poor people and so many people of color are disproportionately represented? There is something systemic here, not intentional, maybe not intentional, but systemic and not random error.
Well, a wonderful question, one that prosecutors, defense lawyers, and even scientists who look at our system study. One of the things I think is the sentencing patterns. For example, in federal court, the federal sentencing guidelines. The federal sentencing guidelines came out 20 years ago or so and required judges to almost use a formula. Right. And the judges didn't have any kind of discretion. They had to put people in prison, crack cocaine, whatever. They had to put them in prison, and it packed our prisons full of people. Here is the truth. We put more people in prison per capita than any nation on earth. I mean, even the nations that we have no respect for, they don't put as many people as we put. Why does the greatest nation on earth put more people in prison than anyone else? It's a problem that I'm sure I'm not smart enough to solve, but I think we have to work on it. But the sentencing procedures, that's one of the reasons why we pack the prisons with people.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about your firm itself, Therrington Smith. It has managed to stay a mid-sized firm in an era where we see law firms being bought out in mergers by big national firms. Is that intentional on your part?
Yes, we've had opportunities to merge and become big, and we've always said no. We wanted to do it ourselves, and we don't take anything for granted. We appreciate every person who walks through the door, and this is not an advertisement, but I mean, it's just the way we go about our work. And to us, there are no small cases. All cases are big. If you've got a 35 and a 25 and it's worrying you to death, it's a big case.
Oh, 35 and a 25?
Well,
oh, 30, driving 35
miles
and a 20.
Per hour.
There you go.
Yes,
my insurance rates are going to go
up. I'm sorry.
I get it. Been so long, though there was a time. So, let me ask you about this is obviously a stressful job. What do you do? What do you do for relaxation?
Well, I love music. I am very modestly talented. Maybe not at all talented, people would say. But I do love it. I love, I like to play with a group called the Southern String Band. We play fiddle tunes. I play with Bloomsbury. It's a band that's 50 years old. We sing the same three songs for 50 years. I love this little group called the Road Hard String Band, Jim Jenkins. So I like music. Music has been very helpful to me in dealing with stress, and also painting. I like to paint. Most of my best paintings are under the bed in the front room at the house. But I do that. So, yes, I think those things are essential.
You met Doc Watson?
Oh, I knew Doc Watson.
Yeah?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about knowing him.
Well, you know, when I first came to Raleigh to work, a young guy named Doc Watson came to play at a place called the Sidetrack, I believe it was, a little coffee house. I went, heard him. I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like it. So I the next week, went back to my office, and I wrote him a letter. And I just put Doc Watson, Deep Gap, North Carolina. I had no address. I said, Mr. Watson, I'd like to come see you. And if I don't hear from you, I'm going to come this Saturday. So I went to Deep Gap, having no idea where he lived, and I went to a place called Deep Gap Lumber Company, and I said, do any of you know Doc Watson? They said, is that guy who plays guitar? Yes. They said, well, go down the bottom of the hill, take a left, go out a dirt road, you'll come to his house. And I went. I had a wonderful day with him. And it was a lifelong friendship.
Wow, it sounds great. You've been practicing law now for more than 50 years.
Yes.
Can you imagine retirement? Have you imagined retiring?
Well, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I hope I don't have to anytime soon. I know that Father Time is undefeated, and I'm aware of that, and I know that I'm lucky to be healthy at this age. And I'm just hoping to keep on going a while longer if I can.
And I guess the other thing that takes the edge off is grandchildren.
Oh, I love to talk about grandchildren. Mine are the best.
No, actually, there I disagree completely, and I will win this case. Mine are the best.
Well, we'll have to.
It's my show, and they're my
grandchildren. Well, I guess I'll yield.
You have to yield to that one. We'll have you back. We'll talk about the grandkids.
I'm up for that.
The grandchildren show. Do you have any cases that really kind of stand? I mean, obviously, they're the big cases that we all remember you had, but are there any cases that stand out in your mind?
Well, yes, so many do. So many stand out in my mind. There are just dozens and dozens of them. Of course, the one that I think about most of the time is the McDonald case, which was 1979 trial. The case events occurred in 1970. But so the trial was 9 years later, and I worked on that case with other lawyers. And it's a haunting memory because we lost that case, and I've always felt we should have won it. So that loss has stayed with me.
Was there a lesson that you learned in that, or was it so unique that there
Well, you know, many lessons. I mean, there are lessons about jury selection in that case. There are lessons about too much cross-examination in that case, wearing the jury out. I can see so many errors that we made. And so many ways I would want to do it different now.
Wade Smith, defense attorney in Raleigh with Therrington Smith. Thank you so much for being here. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more about our show and everybody we talk to at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.